Welcome to the G&JB Show, episode 52. Jack Bowen, how are you, mate?
I'm good, White Axe. How are you?
Good, thanks, mate. The White Axe. Today we have Chris McCullen here. G'day, Macca.
White Axe, Jack Bowen.
How are you, mate? You good?
Yeah, all good, yeah. Looking forward to today, that's for sure.
Be a bit of fun. Chris, he does it every week and all the guests go, what's this White Axe? Who's this White Axe? So you... The original, you can tell them how it really started, all the bullshit.
I do find myself in this position a lot. I seem to say something and it sticks. But the White Axe came from, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, whatever. But there was a fighter, a trainer, Sil Johns. It was either from Sil or his son, Tyler Johns.
It was his son.
But he was nicknamed the Black Axe. Young fellow from Gabingai Boxing Club, and Sil, awesome guy, did a lot for boxing and the sport. And yeah, there was the Black Axe, and one day we were with the White Axe, and he was Gareth then, but we went, well, he can be the White Axe, and the White Axe just stuck. So you had the Black Axe and the White Axe.
And this bloke here, mate, we didn't really say much about it since. I had this fight at the Logan PCYC, remember a body shot?
Yeah.
And you were writing for the paper then. You were writing. Yeah. You had spent Logan Albert News.
Well, we used to have Liam White do it, but Liam struggled a little bit getting the wording out there. But then he asked me, could I see this guy? And that's where it came from. But, yeah, I had the upper hand and could really say what I want.
You've had that a few times in your career too. Yeah. Had the upper hand saying a few things about Gareth. Oh, I remember one time I was watching the fights, and it might have been Damien Cooper. Yeah, and he goes, former Manpower dancer, Gareth Williams. And you obviously won't know until you watch it back.
He rang me on the way home.
I bet he did.
I rang him on the way home, and he's just laughing. This bloke pissing himself, laughing. And he goes, What are you talking about? And I said, mate, I've had that many text messages from people. Did you used to dance in Manpower? I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah, that was, a good spot that I had. But, yeah, I did do that a few times to a few different people, was able to stitch them up. And I guess there's a saying, something like you never piss off the person with the microphone or play pranks on them, because they can always get you back on a bigger stage. So
it's pretty good form, Chrissy.
That's good. Mate, take us way back to where you were born, where you grew up and your childhood and what that, a bit about your life story, Macca.
Yeah, born and bred in Brisbane, grew up in the great Woodridge, Logan area, and played rugby league for Logan Brothers most of my life, a little bit at Logan Scorpions as well, where we met. Played up as a young fella, running around, being silly, getting on the drink.
Who would they know that was around that club at that time? That, people that went on and made it.
Yeah, there was, coming through as I was in the sort of opens grade, it was only second grade football, what they call park footy or pub footy or something, where you played in the opens, but it was good tough footy, sometimes a bit rough as well. But, yeah, in the younger grades, there was Mark Tupi, Corey Parker, Cameron Smith, they were probably the main guys at that era coming through.
What, Cameron Smith's dad a coach or manager of you or something?
Yeah, Wayne, he was our coach under 15s and 16s. Mm. And I guess that's where we can see. He actually taught me a lot about, just your training aspect. He always trained us hard, but Cameron would always be this little kid that just followed his dad everywhere. So he'd do his own training, but then he'd just constantly run up and down the field when we trained, chip and chase, chasing balls, joining with us. He was just with his dad doing extra stuff all the time. So he had his own training, and then he'd come join us. And I remember his dad saying, it's the good players, the top. It's so true with boxing as well. It's the good players that struggle when they're older. It's the second and third tier down that are used to the hard work, and they keep working hard, and hard work overtakes that talent all the time. And 99% of the time, that's true. And you go back and look at boxing and rugby league and see how many people were so talented, but they never made it. And then you've got those hard workers underneath, one spot under, two spots under, and they achieve so much more because they're used to hard work. And it's just so true, that saying.
I think you can say that there was quite a few kids that boxed you, Jack, when you were young, and you just thought they were freaks. And yeah, where are they exactly?
Yeah, 100%. I actually remember one of Chrissy's boys, one of the first like bigger in-house tournaments, Kenny Hamer came. And man, I remember it. But when you're like 14 and you get hit, it feels a lot harder than it does. But you know, I just kind of stayed at it, and Kenny went with his motocross and stuff. But yeah, fuck, early on it is hard, and you got to just stick at it.
But so many times, like people, like, oh, there's people that have, that you fought as a kid that aren't around anymore. But some have kept going. Like Stevie Sparky, Sparky's doing well now. But then on the other hand, we talent like Honey Hooney, Isaiah Farr, you know, all those kids. Like,
well, you only got to go back to when we were at the PCYC, Woodridge PCYC, and look at the talent that was there. You know, the Kramer brothers. You know, Uriah,
Percy,
Mike Percy, Troy Percy. There's just tons of it that didn't go on and do anything in the pro ranks, but certainly had the ability.
It's funny how we were probably the last ones there, and we're still
kept on. Yeah,
we kept on, and actually Uriah's back in the game now.
Yeah, Uriah's doing well too. Yeah. Corum and Cameron.
They're doing good too.
Corum, he was a pest, but he's doing well now, which is really good to see.
They had ability, those kids too.
So talented, yeah. They're just, you look at the, you go back to that hard work, not the hard work, but at least now they maybe missed a little bit that they could have done because they were so talented, but maybe didn't work the hardest. Corum just loved to chat. He's just a laughable guy.
He'd just turn up on sparring nights. And you'd beat us up and then go.
You try and move away from him on the bag because he just loved the chat, and you knew you were going to get in trouble off Liam, that he's going to start yelling at you. But the good part is at least they've realised that now, and they're putting that hard work into other people in their business, which is really good to see.
So, mate, through after, what was your schooling like? I know Mabel Park, you went high.
Yeah, Mabel
Park. What were you like? Were you...
Block Liam now, not real good at it. But I went to grade 12, so... I think because sometimes my head tells me that I've got to do things and I've got to do it for whatever reason, but I probably should have left at grade 10 and got an apprenticeship or done something, you know, like that, because I only went to grade 12 because I was supposed to go to grade 12, and I don't use any of that today. You know, nothing that I do today was because I went to grade 12. But, yeah, I was no genius. I did all the low subjects that I could, and so I didn't have to do much theory work, and really just went there because I had to go there. But,
just play touch and sport and stuff.
Yeah, well, we got a lot of benefits if we played in the footy team, so that was always good. That was probably the main thing I went for, sport, yeah.
Mate, throughout your footy, junior footy, I suppose into the senior footy, all the footy, do you still keep in touch with many of the guys? And do you have any like guys that you really looked up to that you still... you know, you're still in touch with, like mentors, I suppose, old coaches, managers, anything like that?
Yeah, well, I still see Red Dog, Wade Glass. Yep. He's one of our good friends. I grew up with him from a really young age and played at Logan Brothers together. And, yeah, I think probably I don't really see anyone else beside that, but I think influences, you know, I probably go back to, I don't drink alcohol. I haven't done for 22 years or something, maybe more, but that influence came from one of our coaches, Brian Hegarty. Yeah. Obviously, I was a big fan of Chop growing up as well, and he was probably the first influence I liked. I loved that he didn't touch alcohol. And then I was just a big fan, so I liked that. And then Brian Hegarty, our football coach, he, everywhere we went out and we played up on the drink and get up to stupid things. And, you know, you go out and you do the most stupidest things you could, but Brian Hegarty used to always come along and... he never touched alcohol. The biggest, darkest, scariest looking dude you're going to get. But he was just a gentle giant. He's such a kind soul. I just admired what he did. And as I got older and I started to just think I'd want to be like him more. And I only just saw him recently and I told him that story. But he's probably the main one that, along with what Chop did as well, he never touched it. But I just more wanted to be like Brian Hegarty. So I didn't. Yeah, one day I said I was going to stop alcohol. Well, obviously, when you go out, we did it for years and years. You play up, you get hungover, you have a bad night or whatever. That's it, I'm never drinking. But everyone says that. But one day I went, I'm not drinking again. And that was maybe 22, 23 years ago, and I haven't had anything ever since. And I don't miss it, and I don't care about it.
Well, I remember the last time we had a drink. It was, so you met me, you called me, Red Dog, was Mars there maybe?
Yeah, maybe Chowie.
Chowie, yeah. Called us in at the Chatswood where Argery's Meats are.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there was a pub. Oh, I think
it's still there, a pub there.
Yeah, it's still there.
There was a pub there, and we were sat there. Now. And Chrissy goes, well, boys, it's the last time I'm having a drink. I'm having a baby. And we're like, what? And obviously, Raylene was expecting Maddie at the time, and you were, and then honestly, legit, that was the last time he's had a drink.
Yeah.
Yeah, because how many people would say that too? You boys would have thought, oh.
Yeah.
And that's the hardest part for the first 6 months or so, where everyone, now it's just normal for me, but everyone's like, no, he'll come out and drink. Mm. And every now and then I'd go out, but I'd sneak home.
Yeah, you always, it was one for sneaking home even when you were drinking, though.
Yeah, yeah. And then they just get used to it, and then they don't worry about hassling you too much. But yeah, that was the last time. And I remember I had in the bar downstairs loads of alcohol that I'd been given over the years or whatever, and everyone just drank a lot. And you stabbed Red Dog with the garden fork. No, with the barbecue fork.
The barbecue fork, yeah. So what happened? We were just being silly buggers downstairs. So I put the barbecue fork in my hand, stuck out there. It was being a dickhead. Hey, Red Dog, high five. Boom, and he's just gone high five, and I had the fork stuck out of my hand. He's gone crack. He's gone, what the fuck?
He was the target most of the time, the dog.
Oh, mate. Good times, though.
Yeah.
So, mate, obviously footy, we met at Logan Scorpions, obviously. What made you actually want to go to the Scorpions? Because you were real happy at Brothers, weren't you?
Yeah.
Logan Brothers.
I think the at that time we had an under-21s comp. And that year I was playing okay footy, and I got in their VRL there was a player of the year for the whole comp, and I got runner up in that. Actually lost it to a guy who was over the age group. He admitted that later on, but he got me by a couple of points. So he ended up admitting that he was actually had a fake ID and got him in under the 21s limit. But
name and shame him.
Sean Desmond.
Sean Desmond,
you know him, yeah.
Who came later on, didn't he?
He took the score.
Yeah, right.
He'd admitted later on that he was a bit over the limit, but over the age group.
38.
Yeah, we always had, we were sus on that team having a few extras in there, but that's all good, that's part of it.
Did they win the comp too?
No, they didn't win the comp, I don't think. Maybe they did, I can't remember. We didn't win that comp that year.
Yeah.
And I remember just thinking, I might have a crack at going to see if I could play in there, which... I think that year I started the first few games, maybe trials. I can't remember if it was a fixture or whatnot in the first grade, just based on my training. And then I dislocated my shoulder, and then I was back from there on. I couldn't tackle, and that's the way it was. And then, yeah, I had to have shoulder recon.
Yeah. Were you working at that stage too, Chrissy? Like,
yeah.
What did you do when you first come out of school?
Just labouring jobs, pretty much. Again, I should have maybe listened more in grade 12. But anyway, I just followed the money. You know, I'd just do some labouring work. And then my uncle asked me, did I want 2 weeks work, on a construction site? And I was like, yeah, I'll take that. So it was really good money at the time. And then I was in that job for 10 years. You ended up working there as well. And we just subcontracted doing all the elevator work. But I just went for 2 weeks and was there 10 years, run the job for half of that. The company,
But you're always a worker, hey? You'd always work, like you were never a bludger, you'd always do that, you know. Occasionally we had some log smokers, but we still got the work done though.
Yeah, and that's the thing, like we might have finished early or whatever, but we got the work done, worked hard. I try and pass that on to my kids as well, like about it's all about finer details and, you know, actually doing the work and having a good work ethic, and that's always going to get you further. And I see that in my oldest daughter, Maddie, now, how she's excelling in where she is with just getting different job offers because she's such a hard worker. And then hopefully the others following that. Kira's looking to do the same, which she's been really good. And Molly's only not quite 13 yet, but she's already got a job on the side. So hopefully they continue to do that, earn their own money in life.
Were you like that in your footy practice as well, like really dedicated? And,
yeah, not yeah, early.
Hard worker?
Yeah, I didn't learn that till too late, to be honest. And I didn't learn it's all about hard work until it was too late. Like,
but why do you think that is?
I was to make a difference or to do something, you've got to break the rhythm. You can't just do your 3 days a week
yeah.
or your 2 days training, and you've got to be dedicated. Where I was more dedicated to going out with my mates, partying, playing up, and then go play a bit of footy on the weekend. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even when we played the yeah. reserve grade team, we didn't really care about the footy. We yeah. loved playing the game. We lost yeah. most games, though, but it was all about what we did after it, how we went, where we went out or whatever. But as I got older, I started to realise that if I started to overtake people, and I was never the better player in the team or anything like that. I was hovering around there, might win a few awards or whatever.
As a junior, you would have been the standout, I would have thought.
Middle, because we had...
Because you had a gun passing, good running game, and
yeah.
in that lower level footy, well, no, you would have ran that.
We go back to what Jack said, why I know it wasn't a hard enough worker. Whilst yeah. I went to training all the time, and I was only small, but I hadn't physically grown. It didn't grow much anyway, but I hadn't physically filled out.
He got there first.
He got there before, right?
And it wasn't until later on that I worked out hard work. And when I started working hard, I overtook people at a lower level, you know. But all of a sudden, I'd go from maybe winning maybe best forward or best back or most improved to maybe then best and fairest or whatever. And I was able to score long tries or set long games up, play the whole game, do little things like that. But I learned that. As I got older, and that was too late. I should have learned that at 13 or 14, but I learned that at 19 and 20. And then I learned the next level again when I went to boxing, and I learned that you've got to do even more again. And now, I wish I knew now what I know now, so back then, because not that rugby league would have been different, but anything could be different. That it's just hard work. And I think even if we look at today, a lot of people look for easy ways or different things they can do. Different techniques, different trainers, different views. But you go back, it's the same thing. It's hard work. If you work harder than everyone, it's that old saying, the harder I work, the luckier I get. It's so true. The more confident you get. If you shortcut in anything you do, whether it be your family life, schooling, boxing training, then you're going to not be as confident. Whereas I got to a stage where I trained so hard, I believed I trained harder than everyone, and I was confident when I went in. But that wasn't till the last, you know, six fights or as I got older and I worked that out.
It was as your, it was, we trained hard in the amateurs, and then you turned a corner again as a professional, probably after, like, because I remember I'm going to have one fight, professional fight, and then I'm going to have one more, and then I'm going to have one more. Before long, he's boxing for Australian title.
Yeah, and that was it. I was going to have one fight, you know. We learnt that as we went. You know, we probably got taken advantage of a little bit. We were learning as we went, because we didn't know anything about the pro game. But then, you'd had a fight, and then I thought, oh, if I'm going to train, or maybe I should have a pro fight. And I was not in the best shape. I'd won just by a little bit, not by much, but... Then I thought, I better do this properly. I'm going to have one more fight, and I'm going to train hard. And I got in awesome shape and obviously won. And I thought, oh, no, I think I'm stuck here. But I'd learned that, you know, you've got to work hard. And it's not, you have to eat well. You have to, you know, do the extras. You can't just do the minimums or you're not going to get anywhere. And that's probably what separates. Mine was only a low level, but, you know, maybe even the top level, I guess it doesn't really matter what level or what goal you're chasing. If you're going to shortcut, you'll get found out.
I think I learned a lot off. Can you remember when Sam Solomon came to the gym that day? And me and Uriah did a couple of gyms.
Yeah.
Me and Uriah did a couple. I think I might have only done two, and Uriah did most of it.
Finished.
And so Sam Solomon then, he probably didn't have the greatest record, but he was hard and an elite athlete. I remember somebody offered him a lolly. He went, no. I've got to eat at 10:30 or whatever the time was. He had the times and his schedule. He had his food in his bag. And he was he went on to become IBF world champion, but that's probably why, because of his discipline. And at the time, his record was probably even, I'd say, because he didn't have a great record early, did he?
No, and then you can go back to what we said earlier about the hard work. He wasn't the most talented. He had a lot of flaws in his technique, but he worked hard, and that's what won him that title. And that's where hard work will overtake those talented people who skip and miss things and don't maybe put in 100%. And you get people like Sam Solomon who win. Jeff Horn's another great one.
Jeff, exactly.
You know, you look at Jeff and you would think, oh, he's not a world champion level fighter, but he's a hard worker, he's dedicated, and he reached heights that I reckon 99% of people wouldn't have thought he would have done. But
I rate that moment, Jeff over Manny, as, well, in my time, Australia's biggest sporting moment, because that was not supposed to happen.
No, I remember sitting there going, he's going to win this fight. Like,
we were together, remember we spoke about this?
Yeah, it's like it just got... We didn't think Jeff was going to have much of a chance, but as the fight went on, we're like, I think he's going to win this fight. Like, Jeff's won this fight.
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy, but that's hard work. You know, it's not talent, because Jeff's not the most talented fighter that we've seen. You know, if you look at natural talents, there's a ton more than Jeff, but hard work, maybe no one better than Jeff Horn.
Did you have a few extra shirts that day too?
That was sponsored.
Oh, were they?
He was the first one.
I think it was Trent Broadhurst, actually. I can't remember who it was first, but
major sponsor.
Was it me, maybe?
I think it was you.
Actually, I think it was my guy I was helping out. His trainer advised me
that there was heaps of boxes of all the Pacquiao shirts.
There was left out the shirts, and we were allowed. He actually said we were allowed to help ourselves.
So you did.
I think that's a true story, but we did.
Close enough.
They make millions. They don't care. They'll one or two right, shirts missing.
Yeah. Bag full each. Oh, mate.
I think I've still got mine, so been in the bottom of the drawer.
So you had a shoulder reconstruction, you said. Did you end up playing after that?
Yeah, I had two. So first one, I was only maybe 18 or 19, and that was horrendous, that procedure. And I remember saying I went back the next year, and I remember saying if I ever do the other one, dislocate it, because I dislocated that about 15 times. But in the public process, maybe about the sixth time after that, I'd gone into the public process to get a recon done, and it got to about 15 before it had been done. And then I remember saying if I ever did this other one, I would never play footy again because it was so bad. And I think it was the first game next year I dislocated it. And I was like, oh, I'll just keep playing. But then I went to Logan after that. And was it at Logan I first did? I forget. But I remember the game I did it first at Logan. And then through that year, I thought I'll finish the year. And I was in a private system then to get it done. But I thought I'll just finish the year. But I'd got to about 15 dislocations as well after that for that year. And then
we're just popping it back in where you played.
That one was good, yeah. The left one would go back in. I couldn't play much longer. There was a few times I played after, but I was hopeless. Like, I couldn't tackle or anything like that. And but the right one, that sometimes would stay up for long periods, and that's why I didn't want it if I did the left one, because of how bad that was. But sometimes I had to go to hospital for that to have it put back in, and maybe four or five times out of that, which was pretty cool, have the ambulance come to put it back in. But then after that, I got them back to being pretty good, and I went back and did a fair bit of work because I was hopeless at I just was not good in some parts of footy. So I'd gone back to where I loved it, Logan Brothers, and played with all my mates and worked hard on trying to fix a few things that I was playing. I started to really enjoy footy. We won a couple of grand finals, and then I thought, okay, while I'm now in playing better footy, I might go back to Logan and have another crack at Queensland Cup. But in the process of that, we'd gone and started doing some boxing training. I went, right, I'm going to get seriously fit. I'm going to go do that, and I'm going to give this a crack. But I just fell in love with boxing, of learning, I guess. I just fell in love with the learning. I found sometimes in footy where I was, sometimes the coach would say, can you run the backs and run through some stuff? But I wanted to learn still. And then when I went to boxing for the first time, even though it was only a really low-level gym, I was learning again, and I just fell in love with it. So I only lasted maybe two games or something, which I felt like I was doing okay. But I just fell in. I didn't have the love for footy anymore, and I just went back to boxing. Or went to boxing.
Similar story. But you won't even know this, but it's funny. So the Woodridge PC, or the Logan PCYC, there was always bits in the paper about the kids, the Kramers, the kids coming up, right? And there was another gym. Right.
Visions,
right? Well, I said on the paper. We both decided we're going to go boxing, right? He wouldn't go to Logan PCYC because he thought they were because he knew they were good because they were in the paper all the time. He went to the... Are they even around anymore? The shit. He went to the shitty club.
I don't think they're around.
Yeah. No, he went to the shitty club. Like, I went to the good one, and I had no idea because I didn't read him in the paper, but he had. So he knew about it, but he didn't want to get shamed out with all the good guys.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had no idea. He's gone. He's sparring yet? Fuck. I'd been there 2 weeks, and I was like, why are you just punching the pads, you know? Yeah, like, yeah. He dead set had his first fight before I'd started sparring, I think. Or...
Yeah, I'd had a couple before you'd had a spar.
Yeah.
But that's where...
Tell us how it started, Maka.
You learn lessons, and even in the way I am today is identical to that. Mm. I hate the limelight or being in the middle of something that I don't know. It's my... I'm uncomfortable with it. So if it's in this zone, I'm comfortable, and I'll be the larrikin and be loud and muck around. But if it's all these people that I don't know, I'll wait at the back and I don't want to be seen. Mm. And that was that sort of scenario where these guys were all big-name fighters. You know, they'd been in the local paper and all this, and yet I wanted to go to a backyard gym where no one really knew about them or cared about them. I can just sort of sneak in under the radar, and I'm not the limelight on new guys coming in. And that's still the way I am today. But so I went to Visions with a guy named Ray Whiteside. A good old bugger. And
is he still around?
I'm not sure. I think he might. I don't know. I can't say that. I'm not too sure. I haven't heard from him for years. But but I learned. That's where I learned my main lessons, because after my, I think it was my first day I was there or my second day, I forget. He threw me in for sparring. He said, "Oh, you can have a spar." And I was like, "Oh yeah, it must be normal, you know." I just didn't know. No mouth guard, no headgear.
Concrete ring.
Concrete ground.
As you do.
And because I was from football, I was used to being rough or whatever. Mm. So I went okay with another guy that wasn't from football. And he was a bit bigger than me, but we're about the same sort of level. And I'd gone okay with him in spar and had no idea. But then the coach said, "Oh, you might be able to fight soon." And I was like, "Oh, it must be normal." And anyway, that was...
Because you don't know, do you? You have no idea.
Yeah, you don't know. And then I think originally... He had said in 3 weeks, thankfully I didn't do it. I had something on, but he was trying to get me to fight in 3 weeks. So I then sparred Tyrone Tongia, who was the Australian silver medalist at the time, and he punched the living crap out of me like there's no tomorrow. I remember going home, but I just kept going back into the spar because I thought that's what you did. It's just a fight. But I remember having eggs all over my head and a little nick on my eye because there's no headgears. And... yeah, and he goes, "Oh, you did really well, you know. You can fight next week." And I'm like, "Oh, it must be normal." And in the meantime, I'm talking to Gareth, and he's like going, "No, we don't even spar yet. We only just learned to punch." And somehow, by fluke, I won that first fight. And I don't know how. It was probably...
Who was it?
I forget his name, but he was a giant, big, tall lefty at like 70 kilo. And he was from Burley Boxing Gym.
Can you remember we saw this other skinny little bloke, and you were like, "Why can't I fight him? Or was that your next fight?" But turns out it was Ryan Langham.
Oh, I can't. No, I don't remember.
I remember. Maybe it was your second fight.
Second
fight. Did you lose your second one?
Yeah, and that was when...
That was when I had my first, I think.
No, I think you were still at... you still hadn't gone up, but I was with your gym there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's where I learned, you know, that I'm probably at the wrong spot, because I then went to the second fight, which was promoted by our gym.
Yeah, that is where I had my first fight.
Oh, was that one?
Yeah.
And the coach, I was off sick all week, so I didn't train. And I had a vomiting bug or something. Mm. And he rang me up and said, "Oh, can you fight this weekend?" And I was like, "Oh, well, I hadn't been training, but, you know, is that normal?" He goes, yeah, you'll be right. So me and Clark, one of our workmates, Michael Clark, we were working at the uni somewhere over there. So I went, "Oh, well, I'll just go swimming today." That was the day before, and maybe that'll help me get a bit fitter, you know, because I don't,
you don't know. You don't,
And anyway, so I said to the coach, "Well, I haven't trained, maybe just be careful, you know, I don't know, don't throw me in with anyone crazy." And he threw me in with some young guy who was 5-0, and I thought, that doesn't sound right. Like, I'm only a novice who's got no idea, and this guy's some young up-and-comer. And he beat the crap out of me, and then I had your coach at the time, Liam, giving me more advice and helping me out the back than my own coach. And that's when I went, okay, I've got to go over there because he cares a bit. Not that Ray didn't care, I don't say it in that way, but
just
I could
different.
Tell Liam cared about, it was different. Mm. And then, so I learned, that was a big lesson for me that, you know, you've got to do a whole lot of work and a whole lot of preparation before you put anyone in the ring, and you've got to work out you know, can they defend themselves without getting hurt? It was pure luck that I didn't get hurt. That was because it was not from understanding I knew what to do or from any sort of talent or hard work, because I had no idea.
I think, Ben, from a rugby background, you would have been a bit more resilient, a bit tougher too. You know, they probably could have pushed you along a bit quicker, where some kids you come in and they... you hold them off for a year or two before they even have a spark.
Yeah, well, that was normal. And
you're just going, yeah, Charlie.
Yeah, it was normal. And we'd get into fights on the footy field or, you know, like I said earlier, running around the streets of Woodridge, you get into fights all the time. It was just normal. And so it was quite normal for me to get into a fight and maybe win or lose or get beat up or whatever.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really, didn't worry me. I didn't mind the rough and tough sort of stuff. So that probably, I'd say that's all that got me through, because it was not from having any sort of clue.
Mate, you mentioned, we've mentioned Liam a couple of times. This podcast about you, and I know how much he had an influence on my life. Give us a few Liam White stories, or how much the person he was sort of helped you in your life as well.
Yeah, he was a genuine man, and... you know, we could go over on the weekends and do extra stuff, or, you know, he always would answer the phone. He'd always do things for you, but he became a friend, you know, like a real friendship, which is now really normal.
Yeah.
But back then, I don't think it was normal, but he was a real friend to us and father figure. And he taught us hard work, because we weren't a gym full of what I would say, natural talent for pinpoint stuff. You know, you didn't really learn about where your knuckles got to land or where your elbows got to sit or things like that. But it was pure, you worked harder than everyone else. And that's what won us a lot of fights in our gym, was just purely being fitter and stronger. And again, it's all about lessons learning. Don't do what you did at Visions. Do most of the stuff you did with Liam. So, you know, Liam was a great influence of that, not only to me, but, you know, yourself and, you know, the Kramers and Urea and Corum and Carmen, Nick Morris, the Percys, Trent Broadus, the list goes on, Corey Farr. There's tons and tons of people that he influenced along the line. And I think, you know, we're all in debt to him for that. And, yeah, he's a great man. So he used to have some dummy spits. That was probably the best part of him. But he loved the dummy spit, the old fella. But, yeah, he was a hard worker. And when we'd go running on the weekends with him, he'd run too. This old man running up the street, up the hill, dragging his two dogs, hardly understand what he's saying, but he went out and he did the hard work with you, and that's the good lesson about it.
Some of the work, it was less, I suppose, it's a little bit to sort of what we might have gone back to a little bit more, or I brought a bit more back in. Just remember, everything was 50 exercises on the board.
Yeah.
50 snake push-ups, 50, it was just a list. Yeah. You had to do it two or three times. It was like... There's about 800 exercises on that board. Once you did them all, you know what I mean? Yeah, it was old school training. But one thing that we all had there, we had, you know, we could throw to the last bell. Yeah, whether we were good or not, it doesn't matter. We were fit enough to throw to the last bell.
I've tried to keep that throughout. I've tried not to steer off that. Obviously, when I started coaching and I've worked out that there's a whole lot more to this, I had to learn the finer points quite quickly. But I never dropped that hard work thing. Yeah. And I always remember Liam would train with us, so probably not as much now, although I still challenge the guys, although most of them retired anyway, but I still challenge them on the bags or competition chin-ups or whatever. I'm still going, trying to catch them or beat them. I beat them sometimes still, but that's all right. If we were going to do the stairs or... you know, the run in the forest, and I'd always do it with them, and I'd be still pushing them, or they couldn't keep up, some of them, you know, but I'd be still pushing them, because that's what Liam did, and I learned that lesson. If you're just going to bark orders sometimes, not every time everyone's going to follow you, but if you do it with your actions, then they're going to follow you. If they're proper people, they'll follow you, and I guess that's why we kept all our fighters all those years. We didn't really lose many over the years, but that's probably... you know, due to that we all worked hard together. And I think that's a big way as a coach, is to do it with your actions and what you've learned, not bark orders sometimes. When you do bark orders, they'll listen and they'll follow you.
Yeah, if you walk the walk, they'll...
Yeah, that's probably a good way. Yeah, if you talk the talk, walk the walk, they'll do it with you.
Yeah. So, mate, you did. You had a pretty solid professional career as well.
Yeah, I was real. Okay, sorry.
No. I was just going. Obviously, from starting with one fight, only having one fight, and then end up winning the Australian title, and well, it's opened up a few doors after that as well for you. But tell us about that when you were first thought, I'm going to fight the Australian title, and your training and everything. How was it?
Yeah, it's funny now that I look back at it, but I never expected. Obviously, we didn't expect that that's where we'd end up in any way, shape, or form. And obviously, I'd work hard. I'd learn to work hard, and I'd then go into fights. And I had my easy fights at the start. That's normal. I felt, you know, that yeah, I had fighters against losing records or whatever. But I was only at 25 amateur fights. It wasn't like I was an experienced fighter.
There were even fights, really.
Yeah, when you look at it like that, they might have been 4-0 and 4 or 2-6 or whatever. But I'd had no background in the sport bar 25 fights at a later age. So I'd won those fights and I'd start to get a bit of an itch for it. And then I started to get more confident. Like I said earlier, the confidence started to grow a little bit. And I remember fighting Paul Wahlberg. It was my favorite fight, Paul Wahlberg. He was 10-0 with Jeff Fannick, and he was rated out of Canada the next, out of the Canadian Olympic or juniors or whatever, Olympic, whatever team or national team, to go on and win a world title. Then he came to Australia and they raved about him. And I remember being matched with, I think it was Alan Luxford, who was going to be a tough fight for me. I thought, that's pretty crazy. But anyway, I'm up for that. I'll take the chance. I'm training hard. It's time to take a step up. And something happened with Luxford. I can't remember. And then I was going to go in with John Cottrell, which I thought, and this is even bigger again. This is crazy that I'd go in with Cottrell. But something happened with Cottrell as well. And then Paul Wahlberg come in, and I was like, no, why are they doing that? Like, why would they put me in with Paul Wahlberg? But I remember getting that call going, this is a bit stupid, but yeah, okay, I'll try. I'll do my best, you know. I was at a confident level that I thought, okay, whatever happens, happens. But I thought it was crazy because I thought his level was here and my level was here. And I'd watched him fight, and I loved his style. And I think that was a six-rounder. And the week out, Angelo had lost his main event. And he rang me up and said, I'm going to move you guys to the main fight. Can you do 8 rounds? And I'm like, never done 8 rounds. And I'm like, okay, I'm pretty confident. I've trained hard. And okay, I'll do 8 rounds. But not once in my head did I think I couldn't, because I've done the hard work. So it didn't matter what changes had come up. I didn't think I could win the fight. But I thought I can get through the 8 rounds okay, because I knew I'd trained hard. And then that fight came along and I started to feel really comfortable and thought I won that fight. But at the same time, I was okay with it being a draw. I thought maybe I just scraped it, but at the same time, I was really happy that it was a draw because I rated Paul so highly. And then I can't remember what was next. Oh, yes, then I fought a fight not long after that, and I broke my hand in the first round. And
who was that?
That was Dan Cody, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And thankfully, I stopped him with a left rip because I couldn't use my right hand.
Oh, that's right. And, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Then the next fight, I was matched with Brad Hemming for the Queensland title, and something happened. Mick Shaw was the Australian champion, and I think his trainer and Angelo, the promoter, had worked out that Mick was going to go for a regional title, which would allow us to go up to the national title. Then so we'd been elevated to the Australian title, a light welterweight title, and I remember as a kid always missing out on the big rep teams. Like, I'd make the first few rep teams, but again, we go back to that early call of being dedicated, training hard. I didn't know it, so I was never able to do it, where I'd make the Logan one or whatever, but I'd never make Queensland and obviously never Australia. But then I remember walking into the venue and seeing the green belt for the first time, and that was just addicted that I had to win that title that night. And I should go back. 4 weeks out from that, I was sparring Mick Katsidis, and the last round, I'd felt my hand a bit funny in the last round, and as it got cooler, I was like, oh, I think I've broke my hand again. So I thought, I'm not going to the doctor, I won't worry about that. So then I went up a couple of days later and sparred Mick Shaw in Toowoomba, and I couldn't even move my hand, I couldn't throw it, so I just sparred with my left hand. Then I thought, I better go to the doctor, this doesn't feel right, I've got to fight in 4 weeks. And the doctor did an x-ray and he said, oh, you can't fight, you broke your hand again. And there was a small fracture in one of the, or broken bone in one of the, this bone here. And he said, you'll be out. And I was like, in my head, I was like, oh, I'm not out. I'm not pulling out because this may never come up again. All my life I've missed out on rep teams to play for Queensland or anything. Not that, I was any good, but so I just did everything that I could to get my hand right. And there's a guy named Steve Jans over the north side. He did a lot of like acupuncture stuff on it, and I was getting a lot of extra work done on it. And then just with yourself, I just trained with one hand and nothing was going to stop me. I did all the hard work, trained harder than I've ever trained before, but I did it all with one hand, just with my left hand, and I just did extra stuff where I could. But my mindset was, I'm not giving up this opportunity. And I remember 3 weeks out, still had the broken hand, but I was doing a run through the forest, which was my usual area to run. And I did the 9K forest, but I got my mind into a spot that it had never really been to, and I was able to run that even faster than I could, where on my rest periods or whatever, I just did them faster and harder. And in that run, I sprinted the last 2Ks. Like, I mean, I sprinted those things. And I mean, I remember thinking, I'll win this fight. I won't lose this fight now. I've won that. That's where I won the fight. I guess it's like the old footy stuff. They say you don't win the footy or even the boxing. You don't win it on the night. You know, you win it with your hard work early. Well, that's where I knew I was going to win that fight. And went on and was able to use the right hand all the way through with no pain. But that was the first time I'd used that right hand, was in that fight, and it gave me no trouble. And yeah, I won that title.
Australian champ.
No, it's a massive achievement, but it just goes to, you know, all the things you go through as a fighter that no one even knows that on fight night, that you've not even thrown your right hand for, what, 4 weeks?
Yeah.
You've had to do all this recovery and then just getting into that mindset where you know you're going to win.
Well, that's all it is. It's the mind, because you can do everything else. But, again, I didn't learn all that till later on in life, where I try and pass that on to some of the younger people or whatever, because you can do what you want. It's just what your mind says. If you work hard enough and your mind says you can do it, then you can do it. But that was probably the first time I'd experienced that, you know, where I thought, I can do this because my mind said it can do it.
And after that, did you have a defence before Dean Byrne? Was he your first defence?
I might have had a...
Was it Cottrell before Byrne?
Oh, Cottrell. No, Cottrell was after. Yeah, sorry. I think I had a fight between that, which I broke my hand again. Yeah. Yes, I did. Sorry. I had a late replacement fight. I forget who I was supposed to fight. And ended up fighting a Thai guy who was just tough, former minor world champ. Nothing major, but he was just a guy who was journeyman. Should have been a comfortable fight, which seemed a comfortable result anyway. I didn't have any trouble. But again, I broke my hand in that fight, so I could only box with the left hand and I couldn't throw the right hand. I think that was only a 6-rounder, so I was lucky to be able to. I did that in the first or second round as well.
It was a TV show, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's Fox, yeah. Yeah. And I remember watching that back, and they said, oh, he's a bit slappy with his hand, but he's got a good left hand. And I was like, that's all I got. I don't have another hand at the moment. But yes, and then I went on to Dean Byrne, which was a good lesson that hurt me, that one.
Looking back now, there's a few things, like you were probably going through a bit of a seesawing phase in your personal life as well at the time as well, but it was a moment. It was, well, you got dropped for the first time too, didn't you?
Funny yeah,
how was that? You talk about it. It's not my story.
The transition in my life was big, you know, and that's, but I still don't take that back away, because I trained hard and I was in great shape, but no matter what I did, if my mental, I wasn't mentally ready, and it doesn't matter if I was in the mindset of the broken hand or the Paul Wahlberg fight or whatever, I couldn't have beat Dean Byrne because he was just the next level. But I remember the first round, he was cocky, so I still try and pass this on to everyone. I never looked at my opponent. If they sang the national anthem, did the national anthem or whatever, I never made eye contact. I never looked at them. I had no care for what they were doing, because my mind was, I've got to do what I've got to do. So I just did my thing and stayed with the team in the corner, walked back and forth a bit, just get my mind ready. And I remember looking over when I come out, and Dean Byrne's this young, cocky Irish guy on the other side of the ring, and I somehow glanced past him.
Can I just say, and with Johnny Lewis?
Yeah, with Johnny Lewis. Who was
the trainer at the time.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
So no slump, he was undefeated, and people were avoiding him for a reason, obviously. But I was like, when Angelo had rang me up, and I said, oh, well, go for the guy that no one wants to fight. I was in that confidence level, go for Dean Byrne. You sure? And I was like, yeah, well, I can't be the champion and then say I'm not going to fight someone. Like,
yeah.
I don't understand that. So, yeah, we went with that. And I remember walking out to the ring, but my music didn't feel right on me, where I had to feel the music. Like with the other fights, I'd come out and I felt the music was me. But that one, I just felt like, oh, it's really weird. It's such a weird feeling, but you might know what I mean.
Exactly,
yeah,
what you're talking about.
It's such a hard thing that to explain to the other people who don't understand it. But I couldn't feel the music when I went out, so I didn't feel. I felt like I was an ant in a big area.
Mm.
Whereas when we went out at the Mansfield, I was in the mood. Mm. You know, I was in the zone, and the crowd were on top of me, but I couldn't get that feeling. And then when I got up in the ring, I looked over and this guy's desk there, and me, Dean Byrne, you know. Mm. He got me early, and I didn't take my eyes off him that whole national anthem. We desked at each other for the whole time, bouncing up and down like we were ready to kill each other. He was just a better killer. But,
yeah. but that wasn't your go. You got taken out of your comfort zone.
He took me out of my comfort zone. Yeah, again, lessons learned. But he'd won that battle, and then I went out there ready to go. And I think I've seen that fight once back, which I didn't ever want to watch it again, but I remember watching it like 6 months later. And it put me in the same mood that it was then, which wasn't a good mood. But he hit me. Well, I didn't know. I just was on the ground, and I thought I must have fell over. And then I stood up, and one of my legs gave way, and I'm like, he must have knocked me down. And, yeah, he did knock me down. But he gave me the best battering I've ever had in my life.
You did recover, though, and carry on. But,
yeah. Somehow I got through the 10 rounds. But I remember thinking at the end of the first, maybe the third, something in the third rings a bell that I was like, I don't know how I stayed on my feet, because he hit me with some absolute bombs. But I remember you guys, in the corner saying, come on, or Mark, would you know, do you want to win this fight? And I'm like, I'm sort of, but this is hurting, you know. But,
yeah.
But it's like, yeah. Now I can see it when I look back at fighters in the corner, and I know the feeling. Yeah, we don't want to quit because we don't quit, but when we say, do you want to win this? Well, it's just not my night. And anything I do isn't working, and this is damn hurting. But I can now see that on other fighters.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the time, there's no way I would have quit. If someone would have stopped the fight, I would have been really upset. Glad maybe on the outside, on the inside, but on the outside, I would have been upset. But I can see that visually now so easy when I'm on that, when I now, because I went through it.
Yeah, because you've been through that, yeah. I think that's right. Like some moments in training pop up, or whatever you're doing, whether it's Jack or whether it's anybody, come be young kids in the gym, and you just, without saying anything, you just know their feelings at the time.
Yeah, and that's experience as well. That's a good trainer too. A good trainer always knows the feeling that the fighter's feeling, whether it be the look in the eyes, the body language, something they say. Good trainer, they take that on board as well, and that's part of the training. It's not just your physical stuff that you do, it's the emotional part as well.
Yeah, I think both of you have a good radar of that, and there's no egos with you guys when you're coaching. It's not about you, it's about the fighter and the athlete. Where I think, you know, that's probably why you guys have done so well as coaches as well.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely with me, I'd rather stay at the back. It's all about the boys or the girls or whatever. It's
the girls now.
Yeah, sometimes I've got to do a few things here and there, but I'd rather not be the limelight.
Mate, who's the I want to talk a bit about Trent Broadhurst. We both started training with him. He was boxing before us. He was like 11 when we started or something. And obviously, Liam was his coach when we were boxing. And Liam moved back to England. You took Trent over. You had a few ups and downs with him. He can talk about that in his own podcast. But what an ability. And he probably never achieved what we may have thought he might have got. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he fought for a world title against, you know, pound for pound, one of the kings, Dimitri Bivol. So it's no slouch. But I think he could have done a whole lot more.
Yeah.
And if I go back and look at Trent, when Trent was in the gym, Trent worked hard. Like, he busted his butt, and he worked hard. He'd vomit, he'd bust his bum. But again, we go back to what we said earlier. The one who skips that training session or skips this or whatever, they get found out, and that's probably what let Trent down. Every now and then he would miss a session, or he'd have something on or whatever, but it doesn't matter. That's what lets you down in the long run, and that's what makes you second guess what's in your head. You know, I was really lucky. I thank Trent as well for the experiences he gave me, because we travelled the world based on what on his talents and his hard work. But could have he achieved a little bit more? I think, yeah, he didn't touch the surface of what he could have done. He knows that too. He knows, which he was going to try and have a comeback, which I told him I wasn't comfortable with.
Yeah.
Thankfully, he got injured. Well, I shouldn't say thankfully.
Yeah, yeah. It worked out that way.
I didn't want him to fight, and he knew that. But at the same time, I still wanted to support him because I've been with him for so long. And so I was happy to do that, sort of happy. But in the long run, I'm glad that fate played its part and he couldn't take part because I don't think he was in the mental state to do so. But talent is definitely the most probably naturally talented guys I've ever seen. And I remember as a young guy, in boxing, the Chuck Mundine was my favourite sportsman in rugby league through to boxing. And so much so, some of my mates would call me his nickname Chuck or Choco back then it was. And I still see someone like, hey, Choco. And I'm like, you can't sort of say that now. Like, I know him now. Like, you can't do that. But
I'm his coach.
Yeah, because that's just how much I adored him. As an athlete, I loved everything he did. My favourite fighters were always watching Trent and Chuck fight. And because I just rated Trent so high as a young guy, he could do everything. And he was in some deep moments in his boxing career. He took on some big things, which he wasn't really happy with. I remember one fight, he was only like 15 years old and I'd put him in a senior fight. But I knew that he could do it. And I'd fought the guy myself. And so I thought, okay, I know how Trent goes with me. Trent can beat this guy. And I remember telling Trent, and he cracked the shit. Why are you doing that stupid? Like, but I knew how good he was. And anyway, he won the fight and nearly stopped the guy. And
who was that?
Ben Gorn.
Oh, Ben Gorn, yeah, from Cabinga.
Yeah, Benny awesome. Harrington's real, mate. Yeah, real good guy too, yeah. Ben Gorn. That Trent was on fire that night. And then I remember another one. And this was one of the toughest dudes I'd seen was a guy named Stephen Hiermaia, New Zealand guy. And Trent was only, I think Trent was 15. And they'd done a New Zealand versus Australia fight night up in Maribor, I think. And when we got up there, they said, the matchup was, would Trent fight this guy? He's a junior, Trent's a cadet. And I said, Trent's good enough to go up the next level. That's fine. And somehow they left all the blue books on the table, and I quickly found Stephen Hiermaia's and flicked through it to see what his record and everything was, and I see New Zealand senior champion. So I'm like, what the hell? So I go find out what the go is, and they said, he's the national senior champ. And I go, mate, that guy's only 15 years old. He can't fight. He can't fight the senior champ. I thought he was. I was told he's a cadet. He's 18. And they said, we never said that. And so I said, he can't fight. That's not right. And they said, he's come all this way. And I said, okay, we'll look at it. And then Stephen Hiermaia come out to the ring. And I crapped myself on the outside of the ring. He was a scary dude. Trent just looks at me, the most fear I've ever seen in a man. Or kid.
Or a kid.
And he's like, you should be fighting him. And I'm like, I'm not fighting him. And Trent won. But that's how talented Trent was.
Yeah.
He had to find some that night because it was scary. Stephen Hiermaia had tattoos on him. He was muscle on muscle, braided hair, scary looking dude, like, and could fight like there's no tomorrow. But
You're 15, well, that's even scary.
That was the difference. 15, yeah. And Trent sometimes probably reason as well why he didn't maybe achieve as much as he could have achieved. He beat himself up, and I remember again he was not. He was not old enough. He was 16, but he was going to be 17 by the time the Commonwealth Games come up. And he'd been... I pulled him out of the Commonwealth Games trials, that's right. I pulled him out of the Commonwealth Games trials because he hadn't turned up to training. Then his dad knocked on my door and said, I'm putting Trent in a home or something like that, I can't remember, but I can't deal with him unless you can do something. And I said, tell him to bring some clothes and I'll put a bed downstairs, which you will experience. He had a pretty busy room down there downstairs. But so Trent rocked up and I can tell Trent what he's like straight away, and I could tell he'd been playing up, doing the wrong thing because his face just says it all. Doesn't matter what age, it still says it today. But I busted him in the gym that day. I'd like smashed him in the gym, and he begged me to put him back into the trials, which at 16 to go in with grown men is a pretty big thing. But he'd only had 3 weeks to get ready for, I think it was a I don't think it was Gosden. There was another, maybe Trent, maybe from Alan Nicholson's gym. Trent someone. Tough dude, like quite a tough guy. Could box. And he was from another state originally. So we only had 3 weeks to get ready for that. Trent did really well, and he'd only just scraped through and won that. Blonde hair, maybe.
Yeah, from South Australia, was he?
Yeah, maybe, and he moved up with...
No?
I can't remember. Yeah. So he'd got through, and then his next fight was against the tough Andrew Gosden. Mm. And again, we're only talking about a 16-year-old kid against a grown man known to be tough. Maybe not the most talented, but tough. And I think Gosden put him down maybe 2 or 3 times in that fight. Just the difference of a physical man to a kid. But in between that, Trent was just outpointing him at a high rate. And I think he battered him in the last minute or so of that round, the last round. And Trent had dropped him, but he 20-pointed him at the same time. But Trent rose. That was the Trent that we, how good he could have been. Went to the national level. He fought a guy from WA, tough, again, tough guy, but we're talking still 16, I think. And this dude was known, Robbie Bryant,
I remember.
Yeah, maybe WA, tough guy, like real tough. And Trent was so scared, it was embarrassing. He was throwing himself on the ground, spitting his mouth guard out. He wanted me to stop the fight. He was 8 points up going into the last round in the old point scoring system. And he's like, stop the fight, Chris, I'm not going back out there. And I'm like, I think it was Alfie DiCarlo with me in the corner. And we're like, get back out there. You're winning this fight. Like, don't do this. And anyway, he went out and he won pretty comfortable in the end. But it was the most embarrassing thing I'd ever seen. His next fight was against one of the best that I've ever seen in Jed Omani. Probably up with, I would probably nearly say one of the best amateurs that I've seen from Australia. Not one of, if not the best. I just rate him so high. And Jed Omani only just scraped by. Trent boxed it. The fight of his life that time. I think Jed beat him by 2 points, but he had to come home to beat him because Trent was just so switched on. And I went, how can a guy against this guy be so bad, but against this guy be so good? And that's Trent's career, was sometimes he just beat himself up.
Just ups and downs all the time.
Yeah,
his head, as you said before.
Yeah, just in his head. And that happened in the Bibble fight as well. Like, although he blames me, but that's Trent. But I'll let him go if that's what it takes. But,
yeah.
His mind was beaten way before he went in the ring. Like, he didn't, when we were there for 7 days, he did once, I think, he came out because he locked himself in the room. He'd only come down for training. He was just in a different level. He was angry all the time, but I put that down to, you know, the experience and the fear of it, which we were all like that. It was all new for us, but
he was known as a big puncher even then.
Yeah, and it was such a big level thing for us, you know, in Monaco, at the Monaco Casino or Monte Carlo Casino, whatever it is, with, you know, the biggest promoter in the world, Eddie Hearn, and it was all new to us.
Derek Chisora was on your undercard.
Yeah, had to use Derek Chisora's gloves, spare gloves, because when we did the glove test,
the rules meeting and that. Yeah,
the rules meeting, we checked the gloves, and Bivel's gloves, I was like, these gloves are smaller than our gloves, like, why are these gloves smaller? In the end, the ruling body said, yeah, we can physically see they're smaller. Why are they smaller? And they admitted that they had custom made to Bivel's hands, Grant gloves. And we went, well, that's not fair, you, but we use your second pair and we take those off you, or we both wear these pair. And they said, well, you can have the spare pair. They're both the same glove in the same thing. But when we put them on in the back, I couldn't even get my hand in them with no wraps on. So we had no chance of getting Trent's hands in, and we had to use Trent had to use Derek Chisora's spare bit.
And on that stage, there's so many dirty tricks played.
Oh, it's so tricky.
It's a massive eye-opener, isn't it?
But it's good now that we've been through it. But we had to experience all that and learn as we went, because we're small fish in a big pond over there.
Yeah.
I still rate, Trent and Damien Hooper sparring sessions when I was young. I used to watch them spar, and that's the best sparring I've ever watched.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember having the whole gym just watching them two go. I think Hooper might have still been amateur when I first watched them too.
Yeah.
It was unreal.
Even their fights were like just on the edge. Not much happened because they were both so sharp. And I think Trent beat him in the first one by a couple of points, and Hooper got him in the second one. But that's their whole career.
Yeah.
They're both super talented guys. Maybe a little bit let down in other ways.
Yeah. What was I going to say? I was going to actually talk about Trent brought us before when you were saying, in hindsight now, would he have achieved more of as an amateur if you'd held him back a few more years, given another Olympiad? How do you think it would have gone? Would he got through? Or do you think turning professional was the best thing for him?
It just depends who was there. I mean, you still had Jed there. I think he went on to stay there the next time.
And then Fletch was there as well.
Actually, the one after, that was probably one of the best fights I'd seen. Trent and Fletcher in the final in Samoa. I think Samoa, yeah. And that was for the Olympic spot. And Fletcher got him by 1 point, I think. But it was an absolute battle. But, yeah, then he would have had to stay. He still had all those guys there. And it depended what Trent turned up. But, you know, again, he was only 19 against Fletcher. And 16 against Jed, which, you know, is unbelievable for a guy to be able to do that. And, I don't know. I still think he did really well in the pro ranks.
Oh, yeah.
He achieved a lot. And, at the end of the day, he's now bought a house where he got paid quite well. Can't buy a house, but I guess he's, you know, put a deposit down and got a mortgage and that, which that fight in Monaco helped him do that. And maybe a couple of fights after that paid him pretty well, to an extent, small level compared to what we're talking about on some stages, but I think he's achieved, you know, a lot in that case. So.
A few weeks ago, Trent sent me a message, get me on the podcast. He said, I'll tell you everything. I said, well, that'll be an interesting one, but I was going to say about Trent's childhood and everything, but we'll leave that to him, I think. But he had to grow up pretty early, didn't he?
Yeah, he had a tough life and probably, you know, if you go back and I say this all the time, if you go back and you look at what Trent went through and how many people would have imagined when Trent was talented but not a hard worker as a young kid, but when you had all the names that were there in the Logan PCYC or Boxing Queensland at that time, in that era, who would have picked Trent to be the one to go through? Yet he was probably the only one to go through because everyone would have thought he's destined for jail or death. That's it.
Yeah.
That's his two options. That was the level we're talking. We're not talking about a guy who might have stolen a can of coke from Kmart. You know, this guy had to bring himself up. Like I said, his dad had had enough. Him and his dad just couldn't get on. And it kicked him out. And he had a lot of learning to do and a lot of growing up to do. And he was still hard work all the way through that. The amount of times that I was either called and I had to either go see him or pull him up on something that was pretty bad. And, you know, but I guess that's what made our...
It's a massive credit to you for keeping him on, and I'm sure he'd say the same thing as well. Keep his head on a few times. I know you've had many sleepless nights about him, but I'm sure he'll tell us about himself growing up, and there'll be a few stupid stories too.
Most of the stuff with Trent will be stupid, but but look, it's good to see. He's certainly, you know, a talented fighter, but he's a dad now, and I think, you know, he's just got to stay switched on and keep himself on a good level and think about his family first and foremost.
Mate, can I want to take it back to a bit of a rough time, a bloke that you grew up playing football with and tragically lost his life in, what are we talking, 7 years? Six years? Yeah.
Yeah, probably around that, yeah.
Yeah. Mate, I know it's not, this is just about lives and, tell us about your relations with Tobes and then, you know, tragically taken away from us, just from your point of view.
Yeah, we were good mates from a young age, played footy together at Logan Brothers. He's from up north, Mount Morgan, and his cousin, Michael Toby, he was one of our mates, and we'd go to school together. We'd stay over all the time and play footy together at Logan Brothers. And then Jason moved down, and he naturally went straight into that spot, but he just became everyone's best friend and... we were just all close to everything we did. We always did together. He's a bit crazy too, obviously. Hence the situation he got in. That was Tobes. He found himself in some tricky spots. He didn't mind throwing his fists sometimes, and he'd usually get into fights. And I remember one time actually. Geez, he's crazy. This when we talk crazy, we're playing pool.
Is he top runners?
Oh, different level stuff. Yeah. Tobes was innocent. It just was Toby didn't care. But we were playing pool at the Callanvale Hotel. So you had the disco park.
Been there.
Yeah. And then next door was the bar, and we were in playing pool. And I can't remember what happened, but some bikey dudes had kicked us off the table or something. I can't remember. And so we ended up having an argument or whatever. And I can't remember. We went outside to, I don't think we were going to fight it anyway. Clearly, like, this is me. I'm this big and Tobes is a giant, but he don't care. And I've just got to go with him. So as we walk out the door, he's so angry, just kicks the bike, his bike over. And I'm like, oh, we're dead. We're dead. But you don't have a choice. You can't just go, oh, I'm going to run. You just got to fight. And I remember one guy pulling a knife out. Thankfully, the police came because you just had to fight your way out. But Tobes didn't care. He was just, he was going to fight the lot of them. And, yeah, that was Tobes. Sometimes it was your mates.
Yeah.
Thankfully, I was never on the other end. He was always looking out for me, but... Yeah, poor old Marcel copped a couple of hidings off him because Mars was Mars, and if they, you did the wrong thing or Tobes didn't agree, he'd clip you around the ear. But yeah, one, I remember another time he'd had an argument. He just did some funny stuff, and we were at Jacob's Well, all down there, had a fire going, and I can't remember what happened, but it wasn't to do with us, but he cracked this, he just cracked it, and he just walked home from Jacob's Well, which is like, I don't know, 20 kilometres, some stupid amount, but that was it.
Sounds like your old man.
That actually sounds like my dad. Dad'll crack the shits in the city and just walk home.
Yeah.
Take him 4 hours and he's happy when he gets home. Yeah. What are you fucking doing,
But mate,
the Callum Vale, eh?
The days. What about the, like, what was he like as a footballer?
Yeah, good player, real good footballer. Again, we don't know hard work at this stage, so talented. Copybook defender and copybook hole runner. But we don't know hard work. If we knew hard work, who knows what he could have done. We didn't know weight.
He could have gone on, you reckon?
Definitely. Yeah. We didn't know strength work. We just played footy and got on the drink and partied and played up.
Yeah.
But the good part was we were playing under 18s at this stage. We went to Logan Scorpions because Logan Brothers, they didn't have a they weren't having a 18s team or something, whatever it was. So we went down to Logan Scorpions and the team was sort of struggling, the senior team, but they came down and took our player, Jason Toby, and put him into the first grade team. And we just, that was our favourite thing. We didn't care. We just loved to go watch him play in, you know, in the centres for the first grade team at 18. And here's all of us just on drink in the stands just and to watch our mate. And to us, that was our biggest achievement, was just having our mate, you know, playing at that sort of level, and but very talented. And I remember we always had a move at back at Logan Brothers, just the old inside-outside stuff. And the amount of times Toby would score off that, you know, I'd just hit it up, fake inside, hit Toby because he hit such a good gap and he'd just go straight through and score. So it'd make me look good half the time. But, yeah, that was just – he was just talent. He was a talent. But his defence was what stood out. He was just a big, tall fella, not real thick, but copybook defender, and he hit him hard. Yeah.
And then, so later, like we said, 6-7 years ago, maybe he got in a bit of trouble and lost his life. In the, you were around, not that night, obviously, but you spent some time with his wife and family for a bit after that, and that must have been a tough time for. But look, he was a mate of mine, but he's a real good mate of yours. You know what I mean? Like, and I obviously met him through you, but I know how tight you guys were. How was that? That must have been weird, especially with. Brett and Eli. And
yeah, it was a tough time because, like, his wife, Brett, I'd known since I was a baby. Our mums were family friends, so we all became family friends. And then Eli, I was his godfather, and Toby's best man at his wedding. And I remember Toby was the first one of us to have a kid, which was Eli, but he was preemie like 8 weeks or 10 weeks preemie, like a crazy amount at that time. And then Britt rang me and said, oh, Chrissy, could you come pick me up from the hospital? And I'm like, well, where's Toby? She said, he's in hospital too. I'm like, what happened? So we waited 8 to 10 weeks to take his son home and ended up in the other side with some gallstone and bladder or something. So I had to go pick him up and then take him home. But that's how close we were at that time. And, yeah, I remember my mum ringing me. He got into a fight in the city and just bad luck, just got... You know, that's the luck of it. Sometimes he got hit the wrong way and he was only, you know, in a fight with a little guy and he's a big giant and just got hit the wrong way and he died from that one shot. And I remember Jack waking me up early, like I'd just finished night shift, maybe 8 o'clock, and said, your mum's on the phone. I'm like, Mum, I'm asleep. Like, I've got night shift again. She said, you've got to come to the hospital. Toby's probably going to die. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, then you, there's a, probably one of the first real close mates that passed away. And we've had lots of mates pass away, but and close mates, but Toby was different. And, yeah, that was a pretty tough time for everyone. And, you know, but again, goes back to the, you know, we talk about the drink. I enjoy that. I never go to put myself in that situation, you know, or with Tobes, I know if he wasn't drinking, he wouldn't have been there. But that's, it's hindsight now. And that's Toby. Toby, he loved to fight anyway. So at the end of the day, yeah, it's a sad time, I guess, for everyone, especially for Britt and Eli. But they're doing really good now. Yeah, Britt works where I work now, which I saw the other day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and Eli, he's just he's an awesome young man. And, yeah, doing really well in life, both.
So how about this for weird? So I was working with a police officer, Gary Penny. I was talking to some kids. We were going doing our school program, and I was talking about kids getting fights, and a mate of mine lost his life in a fight, and rah, rah, rah. Anyway, the cop that was with me was going, that sounds like someone I know. I didn't know that Britt actually worked for Gary Penny, the PCYC.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she was worked for the police somewhere, yeah.
Yeah. And we were telling the same story.
Yeah, yeah.
He was going, and my, and then we were like, afterwards I went, that's
your boy, Jason Tope.
Yeah, yeah. And we were talking about the same story.
Yeah, crazy, yeah.
Crazy. But look, not to drag up sort of rough feelings, but mate, and again, we do a lot of work with kids, and as you have with boxing, and you know, got your own kids as well, and mate, they've got to know about real life.
Yeah, it's easy now for me to say now because I'm more experienced in life and I'm a lot calmer, but back when I was, you know, 18, 19, 20, 21, it was normal for us just go get into fights. We got lucky. That's what it was, where no one got killed, and you didn't kill anyone or get seriously hurt. You know, Red Dog lost most of his teeth, but that's probably that's probably the worst we got. And, you know, until it come along to Toby. And around that time, there was a lot of one-punch stuff saying, and now it's everywhere. It's all the same. And people got to realize, and I used to get up the boys because they were always in fights. You know, Trent, Aaron, Daniel, always in fights. And still to this day, they're a little bit.
Yeah.
They get into a bit, but I'd say you can't do that anymore, you know. Like, that guy hits his head and hits his head and he dies, you're in jail. Like, you've got a family or, you know, you've got this going on. You can't do that sort of stuff anymore. It's easy for someone to say, you know, or lose their temper and throw a shot. But especially for fighters, it's a different thing because you're not just throwing a haymaker. You're aiming for a certain spot with a certain part of your hand and with all the force you've got. It's dangerous, yeah.
Do you think a lot of that comes down to being on the drink, Chrissy? Do you think that plays a massive part in it?
Oh, it's yeah, 100%. Like, it's the main factor because
I totally agree if someone
says to you, you're just walking with your girlfriend sober, you just gone to dinner, and someone like wolf whistles at her or says something to you, hey, look, she's way too good for you, anything like that, you go, oh, yeah, whatever, doesn't matter, you know. But if you're on the drink, your first thing is, what'd you say? And then that's it. You're gone. You're in that moment. And that's the way, that's how drink talks. Like, you're 10 foot tall and bulletproof. And that's why I started to learn that I need to get away from that and need to be different. And I'm not saying I love when the boys are on the drink until they get to a certain level, then I'll just scoot on out. I'm the target. Like, they'll sort of protect me to a bit, especially Trent. Like, if Trent's on the drink, he gets to a certain level, and I've got to hide, I've got to run, because he's either trying to choke me out, stick whatever he's trying to stick up my pants, like he's trying to throw $50 bills down my pants one time. Like, he's just a mental case. But
yeah.
So I'd always get to a certain level. When I know they were getting too far, I'm gone, I'm out of there. But I love it. I could sit there and watch them on the drink. I love when my mates are on the drink, you know, and having fun and partying. But I know it's just, that it gets to a certain level and then you go overboard. And I guess as, you know, for us playing footy, if you're taught, we're wrong as a country because we talk about, what do you call it, where you drink too much?
Binge.
Yeah, binge drink. Like, we're binge drinkers, you know, like, we just go hard, get on the shots, and we go drink and do stupid things. But if we're taught as young kids, you know, 16, 17, 18, whenever you start drinking at home, just have a couple of drinks, that's fine. You know, you don't have to do this or that. Then we would probably go be completely different, but we don't. We drink as hard as we can. Look at us at footy. The amount of stupid things we did, like...
Crazy.
But that was what we did. You drank as hard as you can, and you did the funniest thing was the stupidest things you could do. You know, sometimes it caused injury, but that was never major.
When you were talking about a fight with the bikies at the Calumbar with Tobes, I was thinking about, remember the golf day?
Oh, you're Johnny Hillians.
Yeah, me and you were going to take on fucking 15 blokes.
Yeah, but you don't care. That's the drink, you know. Usually you go, I'm not in this situation. But
well, we did.
Yeah.
We did.
Yeah.
I don't know how well we went, but we had a go.
Well, I had a dislocated shoulder and I think maybe a cut lip. But, again, it's stupid. Like, why would you do that? You know, if you're not on the drink, you just wouldn't worry about it. We wouldn't have been in that situation if we hadn't been on the drink, and we definitely wouldn't have stayed and gone, yep, let's go. You go, what are we going to do? I go, oh, we're just going to have to fight them. But there's like 10 guys running at us, you know. It's just ridiculous to even think that. If we're on the drink, we wouldn't have been in that situation.
If there's any positives from doing all that stupid shit, hopefully we can use our experience to mould the next kids.
Well, and that's...
that's why we're in a position where we are now, I suppose.
And as a parent, you know, like, You try and guide them as, you know, these, well, they're now young men and women, but back then, they're adults, I mean, sorry, they're only young kids. You try and just at least go, hopefully they can, you know, learn a little bit. Somehow I got every alcoholic in Logan in my gym, you know. They're now all alcoholics and love the drink, but they're good people, you know. Like, so I don't mind that, but back when, you know, my older girls were young, I would... Anything that happened that had alcohol in it, you know, someone got beaten up, killed, car crash, robbery, whatever, I would cut that out and I would leave that on their desk or send it to them or whatever. So they learned that this wouldn't happen if you weren't on the drink. And now I'm really lucky. Kira doesn't drink and Maddie isn't a big drinker. She'll drink and go get drunk, but she's not our level drunk, I'm really lucky in that way. And, you know, Jack, my wife, drinks, so I don't have an issue with it. It's just I know that it's a dangerous thing at the same time. We talk about drugs and all this sort of stuff. Well, alcohol's way worse than anything. If you look at all the stuff that happens, most of the time it's based around the drink.
My dad used to do the same thing. Anything revolving drugs or alcohol, like 60 minutes on Sunday, drag you out of bed, come watch this, come watch these dickheads.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not being that person. I know... Well, obviously, you've had a lot to do with Chock Mundine as well. So, do you want to tell us a little bit about maybe his reasoning for not drinking as well? Because he's never drunk at all.
He's never touched it. I can't speak on his behalf. He has told me a few stories that it's to do with his dad not touching alcohol and knowing the bad parts from it. Yeah. And I believe maybe Chock can come on and explain the story one day.
That'll be good.
Something to do with his dad took him up the cross, King's Cross, and showed him all the bad and not the good, you know, from there. And he learned a lesson early in life, which, again, you've got to have the right guidance. And Chock luckily had that in Tony. And, you know, like I said with Brian Hegarty, it took me years to find that, but I found it. And, you know, if one day some person says, whether it be, you know, one of my kids or, you know, a friend or whatever, and they go, oh, now I don't drink because you don't drink or whatever, that's all it needs to be. Like, just, I'm not saying it's bad or I'm against it. It's just, I know that you can be a better person off it, and I think Chock's probably the number one. He pushes that story so much, and when someone of Chock's caliber and level say that, you believe it. Look, there's a guy that reached the pinnacle in two sports, made millions and millions of dollars from it, so it can be done. He's living proof, and that he's trying to break the stereotype, and I think he's an awesome ambassador for that, and for both the Indigenous people and the wide Australian, for all of us. I think he's a great person for that, and we should probably utilise him more as a country to show that this can be done, and hard work, you can achieve what you want, but you don't need to do this.
100%. And, mate, I just want to add, you were Chock's biggest fan, weren't you, as a rugby league player, and then end up coaching him. So, like, you idolised him.
Yeah.
I remember being at, grand final days, and you were the only one that loved his antics and everything.
Well, that's how I became, a couple of friends would call me Chock, or Choco, because we'd muck around on the drink, play footy in the backyard, but if Dragons were playing or whatever, I didn't care who they were, I only went for Broncos, but if Chock was playing, or Andrew Johns, I loved Andrew Johns too, so if either two of those were playing, I was them. And when we'd muck around in the backyard or at training...
This is when we're in our 20s too, by
the way. I'd be whizzing around the backyard or the field like, going, oh, Chock Mundine, this, Chock Mundine, that, and that's how some people started calling me that. And now it's really weird because, like I said, I know him and I train with him all the time, and I'm like, you can't call me that anymore. But still people do.
Turn full circle. Chrissy's been in, his corner five times?
Maybe. I can't remember now. But not many, but 2014 officially, I think it was, the Rabchenko fight. I think it was 14. Yeah, he'd rang and asked, would I be interested in being part of the team? And maybe for a year or two before that, I was just helping him through one of our mates, Ras, had rung up and asked for some sparring. And I took the boys there, and for whatever reason, then Chock started ringing me to ask, could I organise stuff for him, come and help him? And then he said, oh, I'm fighting this guy. You want to come along? You can come out the back. And I thought that was massive for me. Like, I loved it. Like, he's my favourite fighter and favourite sportsman. Mm. And to be able to even talk to him and, now live that life where I'll get to watch what he does and then, get to room with him and, go away, travel.
Be a mate.
Yeah, and be there when he needs. And I learned so much from that. And, just was really lucky. And, I love what I've got to learn. And we'll see, really. With him here, but it's funny, I remember when he fought Rabchenko, that was my first time officially with him. I stayed with him for the week in the room, was me and him in the room. And on the plane on the way down, I'd still have that on my phone. And I remember writing some dot points and sending it to myself. So if I ever had to remember it, but I had it to remember, but the one thing I wrote was Mummy's Boy. If there's anyone that's more of a mummy's boy than Chock Mundine, I don't know where they are. There's not. Without his mum, that guy wouldn't even be able to live.
And the bloke would have been in his 30s then.
40s probably. Like his mum does everything for him. She's the most beautiful person, Lynn Mundine. Yeah. But there's no one that relies on their mum more than he does.
Oh, so you're in second, Jack.
Are you second? Oh, you won't beat him. Second. I'm telling you, you will not beat him. That guy... He drags his mum around to cook him the food so he can eat at every place in San Antonio in America. Like, she come there, did everything for him. Yeah, she does everything for him. But she does that for all the grandkids, like for everyone. She's an awesome person, and that family's lucky to have her there because she's, unreal. And even watching that family, I love watching what they do, like, and the way Chop handles that situation with his dad and with his mum. Like, they're just awesome people, and that's probably the most that I took out of it was the personal level that I got to see, not the physical of him fighting. I just loved, sit and talk with Lynn or Tony telling your story, or even both of them sometimes, they tell me about the Stolen Generation that they went through and their experiences. Just the best, like, just to hear it come from them. And just the way that Chock relies on his family, I love to see the vulnerability that he has in that area.
I remember you telling me about, I don't know what fight it was, but you went back to the room and all he wanted to do, like, his chocolate was his celebration, wasn't it? You know what I mean?
I know the fight.
Yeah, all right. Well, you go about it there. How was that celebration? And who was that
fight? It was Tommy Brown. And we were staying, what's the casino there in Sydney?
Star
Casino. Star, yeah. So we were staying upstairs there, me and him in the room, and he had a reporter come around, or a journo dude following for the time we were there in the fight, and he'd done well in the fight. And then we went back to the room, or on the bag back to the room, and he's like, he's got nothing on him, there's no phone then to put your card on. He's like, Chris, I need this. I need to get this. Have you got money on you? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, can you get me the Kit Kat? And he always has a Kit Kat, and he calls them Itza, but it's his V soft drink thing, the energy drink. And that's his celebration. So when we get back to the room, he's eating the chocolate, and and we're just sort of very mellow, like, there's a couple of boys. Troy was there. So there's a couple of us sitting in the room, and Chock's just sitting on the lounge casually, as still in his fight gear, eating his chocolate and drinking his drink. And the journo's like, is this celebration? Is this it? And he goes, yeah, bro, I just want me chocolate and me drink. That's it. But that's Chock. But again, that comes back to he's not a drinker, you know, and he just that's his life. He's all about his family and
tight people around him, I suppose.
He has some people around him that lifelong friends to him and family that he's really, really tight with, and they're his people. And but again, that's awesome to see. You know, one of his boys, Lindsay, I remember he picked me up for that trip, actually. Mm. He picked me up and I was like, oh, is this your car? And he's like, oh, the champ bought me this car, you know. It was just I don't know what it was. It wasn't a Lamborghini, but it was just nothing flash. And but he was so appreciated that, you know, Chock had done that. And that's Chock with his close people like that. He always helps them out. And, they appreciate each other, which is awesome to see as well with those boys.
Excellent. Anything, Jacko?
No, mate. I'm all questioned out, but it's been a pleasure listening to you, Chrissy.
Yeah.
It really has, mate. Thanks for having me. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Macca.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks,
you old bastard. I've just got to get this in.
Yeah, we're born the same year, 75. 75. That's all that matters. How old are you?
This bloke is older than me. Goodbye. Oh, that was good, mate.
Oh, yeah.
Still did I stop it? Oh, fuck, I thought I pressed stop.